I welcome you to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word, and invite you to open your own Bible to Judges chapter number 8, where we are going to resume the final part of the story of Gideon, also known as Yerub Baal. If Baal's going to contend for himself, then let him do it. That was the nickname that Gideon's father gave to him. When Gideon first broke down the altar of Baal and the Asherah that was on his father's property and apparently being used for community worship. Well, Gideon has changed at least some of that attitude, I think, within the community. And brought them back to believing in the true and living God being the only one that you worship. But as we've discovered, in the time of the judges, because there was no king in Israel in those days, and to some extent, God was not looked at as being the king of Israel in those days, everybody was doing as they felt like doing. They made up their own rules. They did things their own way. And that typically doesn't turn out so well. So Gideon was God's choice to kind of tamp some of that paganism down. But unfortunately, after his great victory, he allowed a few things to be put in place that lent to a later paganization of the area around his hometown. So this is the beginning of that story. Judges 8:22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." So the Israelis that had seen how great a victory Gideon had accomplished against the Midianite invasion, 130,000 invaders coming in to plunder their crops and their possessions. Gideon had put a stop to all of that. They say, "You know what? We want you to be our king. And we want your son to be the prince." This would be Yether, the one that had refused to kill the two kings that Gideon had captured because he was a young man and fearful to do so. I think he was probably a teenager. We want him to be the next king, and then his son can be our king as well. So basically, they say, "We want a dynastic kingship to start here in Israel, and you will be the beginning of that." Now, God is not the one that has commanded this, and I think that's the reason why Gideon says no. Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you. My son will not rule over you. He who is will rule over you." So a great big attaboy to Gideon on this. He did the right thing by refusing a kingship that God had not authorized yet. However, he does do something that becomes a problem. Gideon said to them, "Let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So the Midianite alliance included Ishmaelites that wore traditionally golden earrings. These guys were traders with a D, traders. They take things from one place to another. Also slavers, which was one of the reasons they were problematic as a people group. But they traditionally marked themselves as being Midianites by wearing these special gold earrings. So we don't know how many Midianites were in this alliance. But Gideon says, I want all the Ishmaelite earrings. Donate them to me if you want to do something nice to me. And so they answered, oh, we will willingly give them. So they spread a cloak, and every man threw in it the earrings of his spoil. The weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. Now, each shekel is roughly 2/5 an ounce. And so we're talking about well over 42 pounds of golden earrings in this donation that was given to Gideon for leading the people in such a way. Now, that's besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. Apparently, a whole bunch of that material that was in the plunder was also donated to Gideon specifically as a big thank you for leading us into freedom again. Now, what did Gideon do with all of that? And when did he do it? And I don't know the answer to the when, but I do know the answer to the what. Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah. Now, an ephod is a very simplistic piece of clothing. It's basically a poncho or a smock that goes over your head with two little armholes. And so they took some of the material that had been captured, some of this purple, perhaps, that had been captured, turns it into this special ephod, which is a... most of the ephods that we see in Israeli history are related to worship. But they could also be counted as something that you would wear to do worship. And so I think that's actually what he originally intended this to be, is something that he would wear specially in worship to God. And so they take that, a lot of those golden earrings, and they either melt them down or turn them into chains or some sort of decorations, and they attach it to the purple that I suspect is the material of this, and they make this really special worship attire for Gideon. And he puts it on from time to time. The next line in verse 27, I think, relates to after his death. All Israel whored after it, there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Gideon, I believe, started out wearing this as kind of his victory ephod, you know, on special occasions, maybe in worship to God. And then over time, I think it became even more of a sign of how special he was. And so that's how it became a snare to him. He started thinking more about himself than about God being involved in the victory. And then his family after him saw this as a power instrument, as something that his son could wear after him and his grandson could wear, as exactly the thing that they had asked Gideon to do. Be our king, and then let your son be our king after you, and then your grandson after him. Be the dynasty that rules over us. And so I think over the period of time that Gideon lives after this victory, which is 40 years, things morph. Verse 28, So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel. I mean, they lost 120,000 plus people. They're going to be beat down for a good long time. They raised their heads no more. And so the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. Now we're going to take a little pause at this point and go to the book of Ruth. We'll come back to the story of what happens after Gideon dies later, because somewhere in this general vicinity, and I suspect it's sometime during the judgeship of Gideon, the story in the book of Ruth takes place. And so that's what we're going to go to next. Ruth chapter 1. In the days when the judges ruled, and so we're talking probably, I think, in the later 1100s is what we're talking about here, which would be the 40 years of Gideon. Somehow a famine happens in the land. Now, famines in the land of Israel were indications that people were not living the way they're supposed to be living. God had told the Israelis, if you live according to the covenant, you will have my blessings, including proper rains and good crops. But if you go against my covenant, you do not live according to the covenant, I will send my curses upon you. And that includes turning off the water supply and not helping your crops out. And you will have famines that happen in the land. So my guess is, and that's all it's worth, folks, my guess is probably toward the later portion of Gideon's time as judge, when he was unfortunately falling into the belief that he was more important than God. After all, he will end up having a whole bunch of concubines. And when one of those concubines has a baby boy with him, he will name it Abimelech, which means my father is the king. And so that tells you that something changes in Gideon over time. But anyway, I think it's probably toward the later years of Gideon that this famine described in the book of Ruth happens. And as often happens when a famine hits and hangs in there for a long time, people feel the need to move somewhere else. So a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. So this guy gives up on the famine-plagued land of Bethlehem and goes to the other side of the Dead Sea into Moab, where apparently the famine was not happening as strongly. The man's name was Elimelech, which is interesting. That means God is my king, or my God is the king. Totally opposite of Gideon naming his boy with one of his concubines, my father is king. Or next verse, or the rest of the verse. The name of his wife was Naomi, which means pleasant. That'll be important later. And then the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. These boys were probably minors whenever dad immigrated his family over to Moab. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went to the country of Moab and they remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. So she is widowed, living in a foreign country. because there's a famine back in your home country. And so her sons are now old enough that they can get married. And so she does exactly that. She marries her sons off to local women. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah. The name of the other, Ruth. Now, Ruth is the one, of course, that we need to pay attention to. She is the namesake of this book. So they lived there about 10 years. So the 10 years seems to represent the full amount of time from when Elimelech moved his family there and then died, and then his minor sons become of majority age, and his widow, Naomi, marries them off to local women. And then both Mahlon and Chilion died. So that's probably 10 years after they first moved there. They're dead as well. And there are no children. No children mentioned at all here. So that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. So all we have in this household is a lady from Bethlehem who has been widowed and lost her two boys, and her two daughters-in-law who have recently lost their husbands, having never had children with those husbands. Verse 6. Then she, meaning Naomi, arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that he who is had visited his people and given them food. So a story had come out that the drought and the famine back in Israel had been broken. And so she figures, I might as well go home than stay here in this foreign land because there's nothing here for me. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law. They went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to your mother's house. May he who is deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So you can tell that they must have had a pretty good relationship as mother-in-law and daughters-in-law. She says, ladies, you don't need to go to a foreign land with me. I'm going home. You just go back to your mom's places. May he who is grant that you should find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. So she wishes them well, that they can have a new marriage arranged by their families. And so she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and they wept. I mean, we don't know how long they'd been married to her sons before the sons died, but there is definitely attachment here. But they said to her, no, we'll return with you to your people. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Now that's a reference to levirate marriage, in-law marriage. That if someone is married to a son of a family and that son dies without any kids, the next eligible child, the next eligible son from that family can marry the widow and raise up a family. And she's like, I don't have any other boys. I think there's also some intimation here that she is postmenopausal and she's not going to have any more kids. So it's a dead end for them along that line of levirate marriage. Would you refrain? Would you wait until they were grown anyway? I mean, even if I had babies right now, would you refrain then from marrying until, you know, they were old enough? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me. That word bitter there is Mara, and she'll bring that up later. It is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of he who is has gone out against me. So she verbalizes here at the very beginning of the story, she thinks God's out to get her. God took her husband. Well, first of all, God sent them away from their home. They lost their home because of the famine. They're living in a foreign country because of the famine. And then God took her husband, and then God took her boys. So she feels God is just doing horrible things to her. Now, of course, he's not, but that's how she feels. No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter for me, to me for your sake, that he who is his hand has gone out against me. And then they lifted up their voices and they wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So Orpah leaves. She goes back to mom and dad, and we don't know what happens with her. But Ruth refuses to leave. She said to Ruth, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Now, this is very depressing to me to read this comment from Ruth, from Naomi, because she is acknowledging that by leaving relationship with Naomi, they would be going back to their gods and goddesses of Moab. Now, the god of Moab, Chemosh, Chemosh Molech, the destroyer king, is a horrible, twisted take on the god who destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, the Moabites and the Ammonites got their start by incest, purposeful incest, during a drunken state of Lot. That's what brought these people groups into existence. And their worship was such that they would intentionally repeat those activities, having drunken parties, having sexual relationships intended to produce babies, and then those babies would, from the previous time that they did this, would be burnt up to appease the destroyer king god that they worshipped. And so here is Naomi saying, go back to Molech, go back to Chemosh, go back to your old life. Rather than letting these ladies go back with her to Israel and be in a relationship with the true and living God. And so that's very depressing to me, that she is so depressed, she doesn't even care about the religious realities here. Verse 16, but Ruth said to her, and you got to love Ruth from the moment she opens up her mouth, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. Where you go, I will go. So I'm heading back to Bethlehem with you. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Now, understand that Naomi is going back as a person without a place to live. I am sure that her property, her husband's property, has gone into the hands of somebody else at this point. So she doesn't have a guaranteed place to live. But Ruth says, wherever you go, I'm going to go with you. Where you lodge, that's where I'm going to lodge. Then she makes this commitment. Your people shall be my people. So she wants to become Israeli. She wants to become Judean. And your God, my God. This is her conversion commitment. I don't want Molech, Chemosh. I don't want the destroyer God. I want he who is to be my God. That's why I just love Ruth. Verse 17, where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. So she is fully committed to her mother-in-law, Naomi. May he who is do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. And so she even takes an oath in the name of the one true God, indicating her faith in that true God. And so when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. And so the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. Now, I don't know which way they came around. They could have come around the south end of the Dead Sea and come up past Hebron and then come to Bethlehem. That'd be a couple of days travel from anywhere in Moab. Or they may have gone to the north and crossed by Jericho and then gone up past Jebus and then down to Bethlehem. Again, a couple of days travel easily from anywhere in Moab. But we do know this. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. They make big news. It's been 10 years, you know, since Naomi had been there. And so the people said, oh, is this Naomi? And you know how that works. When you see somebody that you haven't seen for 10 years, and sometimes it depends on, you know, what 10 years in your life that is, because sometimes there's some big changes. Is that you in there? And Naomi says back, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. So she wants to start her new life in Bethlehem by complaining that God has been hard on her.